Hi, Horror Honeys. We have an amazing deal for you from Adam and Eve, America's favorite adult store. Use our code HORROR for 50% off almost any item, plus free shipping. Yes, you heard that right. 50% off almost any item, plus free shipping. Head to adamandeve.com to find something special for yourself or someone else. That's code HORROR, H-O-R-R-O-R, at checkout for 50% off plus free shipping. Order now and get ready to
boo.
Hello, friends.
Hi, listeners.
Listeners, friends,
lovers.
Lovers, especially.
Enemies.
How many of our lovers do you think are listening to this podcast? Just the two, I imagine.
For me,
oh, you zero. Married your high school boyfriend. I forgot about
For
that.
For me, likely zero, because I married my high school boyfriend, and he doesn't listen to podcasts very often. With love and support to me, he does not, he's simply not a podcast listener.
Chris and I have kind of like a don't ask, don't tell policy, because him being a reporter, he's like, oh, did you read this article? And I'm like, did you listen to my podcast episode? but we do the big ones,
yes.
And then we do the ones that we send each other, but we're not doing all of them, let's be real.
No, there's a lot of content out there.
That he has to hear so much of me, and that can't be the easiest thing.
Well, that's like, we were talking about this earlier, but it's very funny after like being with a partner for many years and then like moving in with them and being doing like the marriage thing with a house and all that, because you go from your text history being like jokes, thoughts, what amusements, like recaps of days,
flirty,
like silly, flirty every moment, to like all of my texts now with my husband are about like our car or groceries or like a picture of our cat. Like that's all we text anymore, because we're together in a house that we bought all the time.
Yeah, and they're like brutalist minimalism. Like I'll just text like shed. That's it's not me giving him a command, it's because we just talked about something and he's like, text me that right now just so I don't forget. You know, like it's a lot of that.
I love that.
It's a lot of that. It's chaotic if you were to read through it.
The lovely little love notes we send each other.
Beautiful. That's what marriage is all about, huh?
That's what marriage is all about. But today, Allie, I have a feeling we're not talking about beautiful marriages.
We're very much not talking about marriage. We are talking about the Wrens of the Cura. Do you know what that is, Sam?
I couldn't even spell that sentence if you asked me to.
Spell Cura right now.
C. U.
Next.
C O. U. R R. A U G H. Cura.
Wrong.
Fuck.
C U R R A G H.
Oh, that was pretty close.
Yes, very, very close. Wait, did you say C U R R A G H?
I think I had an O in there, just for fun.
Okay. But you didn't even mean it.
But I didn't mean it.
So you basically got it. The Wrens of the Cura is what I want to talk about today, which is probably it's difficult even title to understand, but bear with me for a little while and I will explain all of the different words and their weird Irish pronunciations. So I was drawn to this story for a few reasons. Most obvious is that it's an Irish story, and I mentioned before that I'm not Irish, but I do have distant relatives who immigrated from Ireland. I visited many times, and a big focus of my college years, you were there, Sam, for my college years.
I sure was.
Was on Irish dramatists like Samuel Beckett, Brian Friel, and Marina Carr. So it's not really my culture, but it's a culture I really love, and I've gotten to know fairly well. So when I see a topic that's got to do with Ireland, I'm like, ah, I love it. Very exciting.
This feels like a real Hilaria Baldwin disclaimer. You're like, no one claimed that
I did the Hilaria Baldwin episode.
I know you did.
So I gotta walk the walk. And I've been very clear about the fact that it annoyed me in high school when people are like, not kiss me, I'm Irish, do whatever you want. But it's like, oh, I'm just like really this way, like, because I'm like so Irish. And it's like, you're from Brockton. Like, it's fine, but you're from Brockton. But yeah, it's not too far back in my family, and so I think that's totally, I get it. You know what I mean? I'm part of that. It's partly Hilaria. Hilary-ish.
Hilarious.
All right, gotta get back. So Secondly, this is a story about sex work and sex workers, and I have always been really fascinated to learn more about how sex work operated in different historical contexts. It's called the oldest profession for a reason. Mm-hmm. It intersects, I mean, nearly, if not all, every civilization. And I think you can tell a lot about a society based on how they view and treat those who live in the margins of that society. Not just being sex workers, but they're a really good example because they're a through line through most civilizations.
Absolutely.
Especially when you're looking at how they're treating the women in that society who are selling sex, as opposed to, maybe in contrast, the men who are buying sex.
Mm-hmm.
They're not always the same, I guess.
How interesting. How,
I know, that's, I, that's, what?
So weird.
Are you sure? So yeah, that's, I was really drawn up by this story when I heard about it, and this is the story of the Wrens of the Curra. So the Curra is a large plain, so like flat land, of about 5,000 acres in County Kildare. Kildare is directly west of County Dublin, which is where Dublin is. I'm sure that comes as a shock.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
The Curra is common land, so it's for public use. And from the early 1800s onwards, a portion of the land has been used for an army base. At first, it was used as a sort of loose encampment, just like we're here. This is where we're putting our tents. And that was used to train militias during the Napoleonic Wars. The Napoleonic Wars in Ireland have never collided in my brain before. So I was like, what? How were you involved? That doesn't make any sense. But that history led to a permanent military structure being built there in 1855 by the British Army. Because remember, we are about half a century away from the Irish War of Independence. So the Brits are in charge.
Boo.
Boo. I mean, yeah, boo.
Yeah, boo.
Yeah, absolutely. Stop oppressing.
We can all agree, boo.
I think the Brits would agree, boo.
I think many modern Brits would be like, oh, I mean,
this
boo.
Reminds me of, we bring her up all the time, our secret third co-host, our old roommate, Becky, who is British, and she took a class called Non-Western World History, mm-hmm. and the class is just about British colonialism,
yes.
basically. And she would just be like, ooh, it's no good, but I applaud her for taking it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's the British Army rather than any kind of Irish Army. That doesn't really come into it. It's just fun fact. The first references to the significant presence of sex workers outside of the military base began in the 1840s. And those women would ultimately come to be known as the Wrens of the Curra. We lose record of their presence around the 1880s, so that's quite a long time.
Yeah.
And I'll get into why they're referred to as wrens specifically a little later on. But you may be thinking, wow, sex workers outside of a place where men in power congregate. Surely not. This is so surprising.
This is a first time thing.
This is a tale as old as time. So yeah, like, why is this news? Why does this matter? And certainly there were other bases and, you know, armies in Ireland and beyond that had the presence of sex workers, like, nearby.
Mm-hmm.
But a combination of things led to this community being particularly worse off given the historical context and also quite unique in a few other ways. First of all, the Great Famine was right at the beginning of this time period. For those of us who know our Irish history, the Great Famine was from about 1845 to 1852. The famine was devastating and, like, really horrific. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's easy to gloss over just how devastating it was. One day I'd like to talk about it. So many of these women had no family or were orphaned at a young age simply because literally everyone they knew died. Like, anyone they would go to for shelter or resources is gone.
Ugh.
It was common during the famine for entire families to starve to death together, either in their homes or on, like, the side of the road. That's genuinely something that happened many times over.
That's so horrific.
It's horrible. There was definitely an influx of people living, like, at the margins of the margins of society. Like, when I say they had nothing, I mean they literally had nothing. So that's the first thing that kind of contributes to this situation.
The world's most exciting podcast, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, New York Times best-selling author and National Radio Hall of Fame inductee, Michael Savage.
I'm Michael Savage, host of the Savage Nation podcast, home of borders, language, and culture. Hear my new podcast each week as I speak with top guests from around the world. Right now, we have over 700 shows in our library, featuring interviews with world leaders, scientists, faith teachers, and more, including President Donald Trump, Prime Minister of Israel Ehud Barak, Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, Jerry Falwell, and so much more. Conversations and commentary you cannot find anywhere else. Other guests have included Samuel Cohen, the father of the neutron bomb, Breitbart's Alex Marlowe, the great author Peter Schweitzer, Colonel Douglas McGregor. Be here or be nowhere. The Savage Nation Podcast. Catch the Michael Savage Podcast on all podcast platforms every Tuesday and every Friday.
Secondly, Ireland is famously a very Catholic country, at least the Republic of Ireland, even though that didn't exist at the time. Social laws were influenced pretty much entirely by the morality and ethics set forward by the church. And that church was run with an iron fist by men.
Yeah.
Period. Or the nuns who they put in charge of fallen women, who would also rule with an iron fist.
Yeah, it's not like the nuns were beacons of kindness and joy either.
I don't think so. I think we have a Magdalene Laundries episode, don't we?
I believe we do.
I forgot about that, yeah. So aid organizations and workhouses were often run by a combination of the government and church. And the women who found themselves on the cura were women who, for whatever reason, were deemed untouchably immoral or tainted by the church or religious officials.
Interesting. So, like, they literally can't get help.
Yeah. There were obviously sex workers in the nearby cities, Nas being a primary one, but the women running their trade indoors were able to sort of keep some air of mystery about it. Like, they were able to participate in society in ways.
Yeah.
They were still poor, usually. They were still, you know, living hand to mouth, but they at least had shelter and food most of the time. And even they looked down on the Wrens.
Wow.
So the Wrens were often soliciting outside, living on the streets or on the plains, or they were unwed mothers with several children and nowhere to house them, or they were mentally ill or disabled, so they're perceived in a certain way. Or they were, for any reason, any other reason, deemed to be odd or hysterical or evil. They've got a couple rules about that in Catholicism.
That's crazy.
And just not, if you're not fit for society, they kind of make that decision.
That's just crazy to imagine a priest being like, too evil.
Yeah, it's really something. I have some priest stories later on that are quite something.
Oh, gosh.
So I mentioned the workhouses before. So these women were excluded even from the local workhouses. If you don't know what a workhouse is, it's basically like a homeless shelter. And they were really awful. They were horrible places where extremely harsh labor was exchanged for minimal shelter and food for the very poor. Families were split up into men, women, and children, not allowed to see each other. It was a really very dire situation that would lead you to a workhouse. And even that, they were not allowed in. The workhouse nearest to the Wrens of the Cura had some, like, dirt huts next to the workhouse, separated by a brick wall. So, like, not near their shelter. And they had room, for sure. A journalist I'll talk about later was, like, describing an incident where it was like they had half of the workhouse open. They weren't full up.
Oh my God.
But yeah, and they were basically just like, you can go in those houses if you want to. And they were, it was basically like being outside anyways. The conditions in those huts were just as bad. And they had to risk the like scorn and ridicule of society by being that much closer to town. So many of them chose to live on the Kura instead because it made more sense.
Yeah, if it's, would, it's not that it's much like, better.
I'm going to be living, yeah, with nothing.
Sleeping on the ground,
basically, either way. So, you know, why would I want to elect to be near the workhouse where I'm despised? So what did living on the Kura mean? Well, I mentioned it was an open plain. I mean just that. It was flat, grass and dirt, and some vegetation, not like fruiting vegetation or vegetation for eating, but things like heather and also firs, importantly, which is a thick type of bush that grew almost like a low to the ground tree.
Oh.
It looks like a hedge, but it grows like very thick and in like large bush formations. Mm-hmm. And what they would do is working together, the women would dig out dwellings underneath the large bushes.
Oh, wow.
Like underneath where they had like a little bit of cover from the firs. Basically just large holes in the ground and sort of build shelter around that depression in the ground. Very barely protected from the elements. They built what were essentially like nests into the ground to house themselves and their children. And that is why they started being referred to as wrens, because wrens are a type of bird.
Oh my god, that's like the least fun reason to get a name I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's not a fun reason.
It's not like a fun, like, oh, we're a squad, we're the wrens. It's like, we had to nest into the ground.
I know, I totally agree. It's interesting, though, it comes back in a way that I find kind of poignant. But I mentioned that journalist who went to report on the situation named James Greenwood. So he actually like really went out there.
Yeah.
And went like onto the Kura and reported extensively on what he saw there in a pretty progressive and radical way, in a way hoping to open people's eyes to the conditions these women were living in. And he does absolutely like shame them and he's not like taking their side.
Yeah.
But it is absolutely a condemnation of Irish government for allowing this level of poverty and of need to exist in Ireland.
Yeah, that's crazy that you can like kind of still be sexist but be like, this is fucked up though.
Yeah, literally. I think that's kind of the idea. And he was kind of like, you know, how can we as a country like allow this, mm-hmm. basically. So I will read a little bit from his reports. We still have all of his reports because they're printed in a newspaper. Quote, located in a clump of firs and known by a number given to it by the inmates, each nest consisted of a shelter measuring perhaps 4 feet in height, made of sods and gorse. Gorse, I think, is another word for firs. With a low door and no window or chimney, and with an earthen floor, the nest had for furniture a shelf to hold a teapot, crockery, a candle, and a box in which the women kept their few possessions. Upturned saucepans were used as stools, and the straw for bedding was pushed to one side during the day. At night, the fire within the shelter was covered with a perforated pot, and the women undressed to sleep in the straw. In the summertime, the nest gave some shelter, but in the winter, the wind whistled through them. So, yeah, basically just sort of crude shelters that were made by women who are actively starving. So it's not like they have a ton of ability to innovate a good way to go about this.
I'm thinking of a really dark version of those Architect Digest tours that they do of celebrity houses where it's like, here's my like kitchen. We went with a green.
I think it's so true. And I think that there is something sort of touching, though, about like how, like, I guess you could just throw everything on the ground, but no, like, they worked to make a shelf because that felt more normal and that felt more dignified, and they valued that, and I have respect for that. So there would be a higher population of women in and around the Kura in the summertime, but many and children, women and children lived that way through winter under any conditions. So, you know, there were some people who could seek refuge with maybe a family member or, you know, find a way to, you know, work their trade indoors during the winter. But the most, you know, sort of destitute women and children would just be out there no matter the temperature in, like, cold. It gets cold.
Yeah.
It gets cold in Ireland. So it didn't matter what the weather was. That's the only shelter that they had. Some of the women were actually romantically involved or even had common law marriages to the soldiers on the base.
Oh my God.
And they were just, like, not allowed inside the base for whatever reason, probably because they were Irish and the British Army was in charge. I didn't really look into that, but there were some women who were there sort of following their
being close to their partner.
But for the most part, women were there to sell sex as a means to provide for their families, because that is quite literally the only work they could do. They're not going to be able to get jobs of any kind in any place because of the way I described them being treated before.
So fucked up.
Super fucked up. And it's like, you know, the thing that people always do about sex work is like, oh, just get another job. Like, do anything else. Like, how could you do that? Do anything else? And it's like, sometimes you can't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just can't. So, yeah. The army, for their part, would send out wagons of drinking water and some basic food twice a week and would allow them to shop at the military markets. They weren't allowed in town at the regular markets, obviously.
Wow.
So, like, people wouldn't sell to them.
Oh, my God.
So, there was kind of, like, a wink and nod relationship between the base and the community of women. It wasn't necessarily respectful, but there was an element of support that they gained from the army base. And the army base had an understanding that, I mean, they're there for a reason.
Like, yeah, exactly.
You know, it's...
like, we know who your clientele is.
Yeah, we know who your clients are. Yeah, and I think it's really important to underscore that relationship because I am not sure if I've yet made it clear enough how unwelcome they were in regular society, even among poor communities. So this is a excerpt from author Rose Doyle, who has written work inspired by The Runs of the Curra, remembering reading about how the woman had, quote, been stoned and beaten off the streets in surrounding towns. That in Newbridge, a priest had torn the thin shawl and gown from a wren before flogging her bare shoulders with his riding whip until the blood spurted onto his boots, all without a voice in the watching crowd raised in protest.
What the fuck?
There's more. She also said, I'd read how another priest made a practice of pouncing with scissors onto wrens who ventured into the towns and cutting their hair close to the head.
What the fuck?
Like, cutting their hair off to kind of, like, show to everyone that they were disgraced.
Oh, my God.
Men of God, right?
Yeah, it just makes no... I mean, I'm not a religious person, but still I'm just like, that's not what it's about, squad. That's just not what it's about.
No, it's horrifically fucked up. Yeah, that's the way it is.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
So this is something so much more violent than poverty, as we typically understand it. There is this hatred and like emotional disgust that is just immovable. And that, I think, can be attributed pretty directly to the church's influence. Like, mm-hmm. That's just the truth. Like, as they saw it good practice to use these women as a rallying point. Like, oh, we can all agree that these women are the lowest of the low and that they're evil. And so it was sort of good PR, basically, for them to treat these women this way because everyone sort of joined in. And it was a way of you know, even further ingratiating themselves into society. And naturally, they were not allowed in church. Greenwood writes about how they had to, quote, thank God by themselves.
Oh.
Yeah. They were also seen as basically like a scourge on the army. So like when sickness and disease spread through the army base, and there were a significant amount of soldiers who were in the hospital or what have you due to STIs or other illnesses, they would be blamed for basically single-handedly spreading sexually transmitted disease. Do we all see the little omission with that?
Yeah, I mean, it seems pretty clear to me that they didn't walk into the base and touch all these penises without anyone realizing. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Absolutely. And obviously, there was nothing but respect and admiration for the men in the army,
of
right?
Of course.
They were seen as, like, hurting these noble, honorable men.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so that. So, and they were also often rough or sometimes violent with the women who were outside of the base. There were also many reports of local gangs of men from the town coming in and either, you know, enacting violence upon them or burning down their shelters was something that happened many times.
Oh my, what the fuck?
Like, basically, like, for their own entertainment.
Ugh.
So they would just rebuild. Like, they'd move over and rebuild under new bushes, basically. So, yeah, this is an incredibly dire situation. Life on the Curra was brutal, like day to day, just brutal. However, why I really wanted to talk about this topic, and I think the most important and enduring part of this story, is how women worked together to make use of what little they had.
Yeah.
They basically instituted like a leaderless cooperative way of life where everything they were able to bring in was shared equally by all of the women and children. There were many women who were too old or otherwise unable to engage in sex work. Like, they couldn't all, you know, work, basically. Yeah. So those women would watch the children of the women who were going to the army barracks, and they would prepare meals. If someone was sick or injured, they were often unwelcome at regular hospitals, of course, so they would use their own homemade remedies and treatments to the best of their ability. And even if someone was unable to contribute, they were still taken care of.
Aww.
Author Orla McCallenden summed it up pretty succinctly. Quote, banned from the local towns and subject to violence, persecution, and torment, the women developed their own society of outcasts, a cooperative communal way of life, where every penny, every task, every joy and sorrow was equally shared. And I think this is why I have such affection for this story in a way. Like, they didn't end up bettering their situation, mm-hmm. you know, unfortunately. Eventually the community sort of spread out and disbanded, but this isn't like a heroic story
no.
of them rising above their situation, which I think is what we're conditioned to want. They weren't able to rise above their situation. They couldn't. But these women relied on each other and helped each other and formed a kind of community based on kindness and generosity. And what really gets to me is these women had every reason to steal from each other.
Yes.
To fight, to take scraps wherever they could. They were physically depleted, beaten down, starving, freezing, and they would still come together to equally ration out all of their supplies.
That's amazing.
That's incredible to me. So they really honored each other, even at like this inhumane level of treatment and this sort of inhumane situation. They saw each other as people and treated each other as people and as neighbors, basically, as sisters in a way. And I just find that so inspiring and so indicative of what we already know to be true, which is that when women come together, there's often a sort of like alchemy or magic that happens where things get done, but everyone is lifted up in the process. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, women are able to forge these environments where everyone feels cared for and, you know, things are moving forward with the understanding that everyone's humanity matters in that moving forward. And I just have such respect and admiration for the strength and intelligence these women showed in the face of absolute destitution. You know, they were smart. They used what they could and they made plans and they helped each other. And again, I'm not an Irish citizen. I don't fully understand Irish culture. However, I have observed studying history these incredible patterns of Irish communities, particularly Irish women, having this indomitable spirit in the face of hardship. That seems to really be part of the national identity. And Ireland is often contextualized in its relationship to hardship. Yeah. that's how a lot of its artists, its writers, its musicians express their, you know, connection to their country is in the context of oppression. And so being an oppressed state means women are oppressed within an oppressed state. And there is this strength and intensity that manages to charge forward even in the wake of that. Maybe I'm just emotional because Sinead O'Connor died last year, who I love. She was a huge inspiration to me in terms of her activism and her mental health advocacy. So she's a great example of that. Mm-hmm. But she has nothing to do with this. Anyways, I think I talked about her in my Magdalene Laundries episode, though I'm positive that she knew about this story, and I'm sure that she felt the same way.
Yes, definitely.
So yeah, I think more people should know about these women. Regardless of your views on sex work, I think they deserve respect and admiration for the ways they continue to care for each other and for their children. And that's really it. That's the story. There's unfortunately no happy ending.
Yeah.
But there was such beautiful care and kindness and humanity that existed there. And I would like for that to be seen sort of moving in the footnotes of history.
Definitely.
Which is where they are. They're in the footnotes of history.
Yeah. But no, that, I mean, that struck me even as you were telling the story, like initially when you were talking about like them working together to build these like very sad sounding, but like, you know, functional shelters. Like, it's just so amazing what community can do, like in the worst circumstances.
Yes.
Like finding community in circumstances that are like so heinous.
Yeah.
And being able to like use that to collectively make life a little bit less heinous, even though it's still quite heinous, like,
and it's,
is such an amazing thing.
And it's so like in contrast with, you know, and I understand when society breaks down under destitution. Like that makes sense to me. If you have nothing and you're, you know, going wild with hunger and need for shelter, I can understand you lose your mind a little bit. Like you're scraping for the bare minimum. And the fact, so I have a lot of understanding and empathy for people who, you know, pull away from society because of that situation. I think that's something that happens a lot, but it is so incredible, I think, how all of them were in that situation. None of them could keep a straight head on their shoulders, probably. They were, you know, beaten down completely, and they still managed to do this. Yeah. And they managed to do it together. And I just think that's really, really beautiful. So, yeah, that's the Wrens of the Curragh.
Oh, my goodness. I went from not even being able to spell it to tearing up a little bit hearing about them. Oh my gosh.
Now you know how to spell it.
And now I know how to spell it, and I will.
I think one is the, you know, respect and honor to be laid upon them for history. That's my goal. But then separately, now you can spell.
If I feel a little bit better about spelling,
you could spell this one word that you will likely never write down again.
And to be honest with you, when we started this story, I thought Wrens was going to be R-E-N-S. And I was wrong about that, too.
The W is out of nowhere. That's totally fine. That makes sense. I will say, for all that I love about Ireland, their spelling is absolutely buck wild.
It is hard for non-Irish
people to follow, I think. It's extremely confusing.
I'd argue not as bad as Welsh.
Welsh, to me, is like unintelligible. Like, I can't even start speaking it. But I love it because when I hear it spoken, it's really quite amazing.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It's got sounds. And this is true of some languages. Like, some languages just have sounds that other languages don't have. And
yes.
So, like,
yeah.
As a non-native speaker, when you even try to go speak it, it's like, what?
Yeah.
Are you talking
exactly.
about? And
exactly.
And I think Welsh is one of those where it's like, a double f- like what?
Yeah. It's, you're like, wait, you run that back really yeah. quick? What did you say? Yeah. Ugh. The world is so full of amazing pieces of culture and history.
Yes. And even when they're sad, we can find the kernel of maybe okay in there.
Yeah, that definitely, I think, is important.
But we personally really have to focus on the sad stuff because that's our brand.
Yeah, we have our brand to think about.
Yeah, so it's humanity's one thing. Our brand is something really different.
That's true. And I'm not saying it's more important.
No.
I might be saying it's as important.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That feels right to me.
If you agree that our brand is as important as the trend of good in history, please like and subscribe to our podcast.
Oh, she did that. She dropped it in. That is right. Thank you. Thank you for that seamless transition.
If you believe history tends toward the good, please subscribe to our podcast.
Absolutely.
To be proven wrong.
So thank you for listening.
Thank you.
And I am excited to hear what you have to talk about next week. Is it sad history?
Well, here's a question, right? Here's a teaser for next week for everybody. Think about this. Do you consider 2004 history?
Oh,
big question.
We're gonna let you marinate on that one for a full week.
Huge question to think about. And until we answer that question next week, bye bye, horror honeys.
We'll see you next Tuesday.
I'm Horrified is a Hemlock Creatives production, recorded and produced by us, Sam Bierstow and Allie Gavin, in Boston, Massachusetts. Our art is by Leah Brilliard and Allie Gavin. You can find us on Twitter at I'm Horrified Pod and at I'mHorrifiedPodcast.com. And you can tell us what horrifies you at I'mHorrifiedPodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us directly on Patreon, you can get our podcast early and ad-free, as well as bonus episodes of our members-only minicast, I'm Thrilled! Check us out at patreon.com/I'mHorrified. And if you liked hanging out with us, tell your friends, share us on your socials, and leave us a review wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for stopping by, Horror Honeys.